So you're the other ones who didn't get an invitation to the beach for the weekend. I didn't know who it'd be, but I'm glad. Thank you for coming here and at least being with me this week here on the Lord's Day. No, you're here because it is the Lord's Day. That's what we've come to do, and that's what we've been doing this hour. We worship a living God, and it's a privilege. I stole a glance at Elizabeth just a minute ago as the first verse of Holy, Holy, Holy unfolded. I looked at her, she looked at me, and she smiled, and I held up one finger, and you need to know why. I don't think I've ever told you this before. On my first visit here, we were walking through the sanctuary. The search committee had snuck me into town, as they dutifully do with any candidates in a stage like that. And we were walking through here, and I noticed that the 91 hymnal was in the pew racks at that time. And they said, "Oh, but we have just voted to buy the new hymnal." And I said, "Oh, which new hymnal is that?" And they said, "Well, it's the Celebrating Grace hymnal, and we'll be getting that in the next few months." And I said, "Oh, well, when you do, turn to Roman numeral 7, and you'll see my name, because I was on one of the committees that put this hymnal together." I want you to know that on the first day that I left the house to go to a committee meeting for that, Elizabeth said, "I got two requests." I said, "Okay, what are the two requests?" She said, first of all, she named a hymn I will not name on the radio that was in an old hymnal. She said, "Please make sure that is not in the new hymnal." I said, "Okay, I get that. I share that with you. What's the other thing?" She said, "Please put Holy, Holy, Holy back on page one where it belongs." And we did. Page one has Holy, Holy, Holy. And every time we sing that song, I look at her and we share a grin. Thank you for your worship today, your active worship today on this Sunday, when we have so many themes playing their way through. And of course, God is the most important of our attention, our focus on this day. Well, a year ago, I had arrived newly here and was settling in. Elizabeth had not yet moved here. Under the happiest of circumstances, moving and resettling in an unfamiliar place is not easy in some ways, right? Truth is, we were on an exciting adventure and loving to getting to know you all. And we were being uprooted from a very, very familiar place and a familiar people, where family and friends were all around us. Both things were true all at once. You are an easy congregation to get to know and love. But at first, she wasn't up here with me, since she needed to fulfill her contract at the school down there. And we had some fine-tuning to do with our house down in Atlanta to get it ready to go on the market. Meanwhile, with Spartan belongings that I could grab without tearing that house apart, I moved up here into the house we're now in Franklin, and did what I call camping out for a few months. Fortunately for us, this period of time only lasted a few months. Quickly, you became church and friends, support and encouragement to us as newcomers. We have seen others endure far worse, to be sure. But we learned what some friends had told us over and over. When you have houses in two cities and aren't living under the same roof, you aren't really settled in either place until you can resolve that. Life can put us in a period of exile, can't it? I'm compelled to state the obvious. Our temporary discomfort in that story pales in comparison to true exile that occasionally unfolds in front of us in global news. We see displaced people due to civil unrest, flight from genocide, natural disasters, and the like. It's painful to see how life can suddenly uproot you. Sometimes we see people make a return of sorts. Often, though, there simply is no option of return. If you're in between jobs and truly want to work, you're in an exile of sorts. The death of a loved one, expected or not, can unhinge our homes and send us into a time of relational and emotional wandering. Families with divorce or estrangement live in exile, wondering how to adjust to a new reality, hoping against hope that better days might be ahead. If you or a loved one is battling an extended illness and you aren't sure how or when things are going to be resolved, you are living in a hard period of exile. I just finished reading Kate Bowler's recent book, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. And in it, this Duke Divinity School professor talks about her ongoing journey with stage 4 cancer. And although an experimental treatment protocol is right now sustaining her life this minute, she lives that life within the 2-month blocks that are the time between checkups to see if she gets to stay in the protocol, the study program, and therefore keep receiving the medications that are sustaining her life. She wonders if her 2-year-old, if she will die before her 2-year-old son ever develops a true memory of who she was. Life can spiral us into exile. In this book, Kate Bowler talked about the helpful things that people and family and strangers alike had done for her that make the load a little more bearable. She also talked candidly about what others said or did that simply made things worse. We have this word from Jeremiah that you heard earlier. Thank you, Betty, for reading that for us. And like Kate Bowler and any other person in exile, the children of Israel were hearing things that just didn't help much. The Babylonians had swooped in and taken the Israelites out of Jerusalem and the surrounding territories. If you want a biblical parallel, this episode from Jeremiah 28:29 appears to speak to the period portrayed in 2 Kings 24. And it happened in about 586 B.C., the longer they stayed there in Babylon, they realized that life was actually sustainable in their new places. The system was set up such that these displaced people had freedoms. They had some flexibility to live their lives in accustomed ways. Still, this wasn't home. It wasn't their place, and they did not have ultimate say-so in so many ways. They were in exile. Sometimes they felt as though the God of their faith and the practices of that faith anchored back home in Jerusalem had also been taken away from them. They had been stripped of what they thought made them the very people that they were. In a nice bit of scriptural documentation, Psalm 137 also speaks to this episode. And it was written precisely by these saddened children of Israel. It captures their lament. Here's some from Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows, there we hung up our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs, and our tormentors asked for mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Well, how could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you. If I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. False prophets were swirling around in this time, it seems, speaking into their days with words that couldn't stand up to the test of time. Words that on the surface of them sounded like welcome prophecy, but turned out to be nothing but flagrant attempts to grab their attention and a bit of local power. What was so bad about the news coming from these false prophets? Well, I don't exactly know how to say this, except to say it. The news was coming up all too rosy. One prophet was named Hananiah, for instance. And what was the problem with Hananiah? After all, he was handsome, articulate, and dynamic. When he preached, he probably didn't use notes. And he spoke either in a broadcaster's voice or in a compelling accent that is not traceable to any region of the United States. Oh, that's what makes preachers popular these days in our time. So what did Hananiah do? What were his day's equivalents? He descended from the Davidic line. He wore fine garments and spoke as one with authority. He also told the people what they wanted to hear. And that's another surefire way to get accepted. Hananiah was telling the people that their period of exile among the Babylonians would end within 2 years. They would be going home soon to their once promised land. Sadly, the book of Jeremiah doesn't give us all of the two letters that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles, but one of them does speak in concern to what he knows they've been hearing from people like Hananiah. And this is not unlike today, where TV preachers and local ones too can become popular quickly for dispensing sugar pills of feel-good gospel in a faith that should be so much less about what we feel and instead about what God would have us to understand. The voices of those who can dispense to us good feelings sure can distract. One of the more compelling articles I've read lately is one whose title tips you off immediately as to the central point. The article is called, "A Pastor's Job Isn't to Make Bad Things Seem Better." And a first reaction to that title and that stance that the writer takes is to want to disagree, but not so fast. Of course, our job isn't to make a bad situation worse. No one wants that. But the author rightly makes the point that when confronted with the choice to speak falsely and say things that can't possibly stand up, always go with the truth. Always minister from out in front of the backdrop of hard realities rather than dispensing sugar and only making the disappointment worse when the falsehoods don't come to pass. You might be surprised to know that one of the most frequent pastoral conversations I have is with people who are trying to choose between all bad options. They'll ask, "Why can't I come to a decision about this that feels good? And my tough job is to start by honoring their hardship and to agree with them that none of their options are desirable, nor will they be. They don't feel right because none of them are going to." To accompany them along the way with what is rather than what will never be. That is my highest calling. Into a people who were primed to hear what they wanted to hear because they longed for better old days, there came Jeremiah. And there spoke Jeremiah. His word from God contradicted the good news gospel. He had some specific points that sounded nothing like a return home would be soon. There would be no fast answers. Instead, he believed that God would have them to dig down where they were and to put in deeper roots. Verse 5, you heard earlier, "Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat what they produce." Verse 6, "Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease." His prescription from God was not one about packing up and leaving. It was not one about panicking or shrinking into depression. Instead, he told them that they would have grandchildren born there before they got to leave. They may as well go ahead and dig roots. No miracle cure was just over the horizon. "For thus says the Lord, only when Babylon's 70 years are completed will I visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place." Well, guess how the story seems to unfold in 2 Kings? 70 years, and then an option for return presents itself. You've been through some hard times here in Franklin in the last 20 years. Times that have made you feel at one minute or another like you're living in exile. You've survived a major flood and another one that would have seemed like a major flood if it hadn't been for the one you just went through. Maybe even worse, the economic activity that shuttered the mill for a time rippled a demographic wave through our city that continues to manifest. We are an aging city now. Some don't want to hear that, but the data doesn't lie, the numbers don't lie. And we've presented that in a congregational luncheon to you. We'll present it again. Many have graduated high school and gone off to college and eventually on to larger cities. Our population has also shifted rapidly as so many properties went up for rent. Add in a dramatic shift in church-going trends across America that really have been unfolding over the last two generations now, and nothing looks like you've been used to. If you weren't at the congregational luncheon a few weeks ago, you didn't hear the encouraging news and trends that are also true of our area, though. We'll be looking to remind you of those in the days to come. Otherwise, it could all sound like gloom and doom. What we've looked at so far from Jeremiah, you might not be as familiar with what you've heard today. What he says after this, though, we know it well. We like it a lot. Let me remind you, but you could probably almost say it with me. There are good words, I think, for the days ahead, for us here in Franklin, too. For surely I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans for your welfare and not for harm, to give you a future with hope. Then when you call upon me and come and pray to me, I will hear you. When you search for me, you will find me. If you seek me with all your heart, I will let you find me, says the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and all the places where I have driven you, says the Lord, and I'll bring you back to the place from which I have sent you into exile. Here is where I have to be more like Jeremiah than Hananiah. I can't unfold to you what restoring our fortunes could mean, or when, if ever. But the rest of Jeremiah's instructions sound like they're from God. Pray for your city, Jeremiah says. Pray for your city. And in our Lighting God's Path plan, we're going to do that, but a whole lot more. Love your city that you're in, Jeremiah tells the exiles in Babylon. Love the city that you're in, just like it is, with all your heart. Dig roots and continue to invest right where you are. Seek after God with all your heart. We're going to try to be better than ever at this one. Seek the welfare of the city. Our call is to make this place we call home the best home we can make it. Finally, Jeremiah says, in your city's welfare, there shall your own welfare be. Now, I'm no genius, but that one is not hard for me to figure out. He's right, and it's still true for us today, Franklin. I still trust those words. I have to. They're the best thing we've got to go by, I think. They do call on us to trust God and to trust that God can be moving even when we can't detect it. Oh, about that. You know why this couple of chapters in Jeremiah went on to be so revolutionary in Hebrew life? Because they broke some news. We hear these words and we don't get it. It doesn't impact us. But these chapters in Jeremiah 28 and 29 broke some news. If you missed it, let's reach back and get it right now. God was saying through Jeremiah, don't worry right now, Jerusalem, about Jerusalem. I am your God and can be with you wherever you are. I can be in Babylon with you. I can be in exile with you. I can reach through your misfortune and accompany you. No one had considered that to be possible. No one thought that God could be anywhere other than back in Jerusalem. Do we think Franklin can be anywhere other than in the loving memories of our pasts? Do we think that God can still be with us here today and guide us to live into the next chapter of our wonderful lives? Your chance to vote on that is coming soon. A few weeks ago, in a message called Go As Far As We Can See, Ben Goodman said something to me at the door that I still smile about, still remember this day. Because I brought this lantern up here that day, especially to illustrate a story that I told right at the end. Many of you have stopped me and thanked me for that story. But Ben met me at the door and he said, Charles, I can't wait till the lantern is lit. I can't wait till it's our time to see the plan fully and get started. Well, lantern's lit. Lighting God's path. We are illuminating God's path and about to take those terrifying, but I think also invigorating, first steps into our next years. If you are on board with us, if you trust in Jeremiah's God, we sure are going to enjoy having you with us and to love our city with us. Our hymn of response is listed in your printed order of worship. It's number 349, "To God Be the Glory." You know this hymn. You may have a response that you'd want to make down front, and if you do, I'll be there waiting for you. If you want to join your life with our church, as two did last week and as one did just a few weeks before that recently, then do that. I'll be waiting for you. We look forward to having you join us and help us to be a step better than we are right now. But if your response is best made paying attention to the words that you're singing and singing them right there where they are, then do that too. Let's stand, if you will, and sing "To God Be the Glory," hymn number 349.